I don't know how long we're going to be embarking on another study on revivals, but you know that now that I told some people that I'm going into revivals, the people that haven't come to the class yet are telling me that they were sorry I was leaving Pilgrim's Progress because they wanted to be in the class, but you know, last week I was spending a lot of time in prayer, and I came across an article that was published in a magazine called the Connecticut Evangelical Magazine. That's actually my copy. That is the first edition from July 1800. It was started in July of 1800 because after about 1892, and there's no exact date, revivals began to manifest themselves in different local assemblies. And we'll talk about later why there was a break between the First Great Awakening and the Second Great Awakening. Why was there a time of declension? And we'll get into that. But the reason that I wanted to start with the revivals of the 19th century is because it has been so much forgotten. And a lot of what I learned about this history was in 1973, we had a Reformed Baptist family conference in Harvey Cedars, New Jersey, and Ian Murray was invited, and he gave five lectures on revivals, and I came across those very, very early on, and I listened to them and listened to them. And over the years, I started to buy the books that he was mentioning. For example, the Log College, which was basically a log cabin where they began to prepare men for the ministry in the 1740s. But it's the time of the revival of the Great Awakening. So many of the people that came out of the Log College in Freehold, New Jersey, also were being used in this Great Awakening. But so much has been done on the First Great Awakening, and still, I believe, for the most part, many, many people are ignorant of this history. And Heritage Books did a revival documentary, and I watched it, and some parts of it are very good. More the 19th century in Wales and Scotland, because you have people that work at the Manor of Truth that are very, very close to that situation. But this history in the United States isn't really well known. And so before we get into that, let me tell you where I'm going to go so I'm a little bit more arranged so that you know where we're at. Before you could really do a book study on the history of revivals in America, and the title is At the End of the 18th and the Beginning of the 19th Century, which was a text that was published by Bennett Tyler, and all of those stories were taken out of the Connecticut Evangelical Magazine by him, and Heman Humphrey did his own. So what was interesting about this time, and what was so rich of this time in our history, is both of those men who are good pastors, congregationalists, they were also presidents of our college. So Heman Humphrey was the president of Amherst College, and Edward Dorr Griffin was one of the presidents of Dartmouth College, which was founded by Eliezer Wheelock, who I believe is the guy that brought Jonathan Edwards into Enfield, Connecticut, the night that he preached Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. But all of these men were good men, and they were the presidents of the colleges. It was a different time in our country. And both of these men were very close to somebody that we inevitably have to study during this time period, and that would be Asahel Nettleton. So we're going to do again a definition of what revival is. What are those things that you will inevitably find in a revival, which will in most cases distinguish it from some of the quote revivals that they say are happening in our day, like the Asbury Methodist revival on the other side of Kentucky. But as far as historic subjects, because we want to go to the actual, that's 90 miles away from here, and we can go inside, and that's the actual Red River Meeting House. But so we'll do probably next Thursday, whenever we do it, a study of the Kentucky Revival of 1800. That way we're going to this place sooner rather than later. People can come and you know, we'll maybe stop at a restaurant or something like that. But the thing about it is, it's not like this is going to blow you away. It's just a building kind of out in the middle of a cemetery and so on. But if you understand the story of what happened in 1800, that's an amazing piece of real estate right there. But what's even more amazing is, pastors were so scarce at the turn of the 19th century that the pastor, James McGrady, who pastored that church, down here in southwestern Kentucky, had to pastor two other churches at the same time. And revival came to this church in a period that they called the communion season. And Michael knows about this from a Presbyterian church in Grand Rapids, where they wouldn't just have the Lord's table every Sunday. The whole week would be really dedicated to becoming communion on Sunday, so it was a season that would allow them to prepare themselves more. And so this had been going on for a week in June of 1800. There was a communion season going on because James McGrady was a Presbyterian pastor. And so we'll get into that next week if we do the 19th century. The Great Revival of 1800, it is called. There's numerous books on it. But the one that's really interesting that I've narrated a good part is called The Revival of 1800 by William Spear. So first, the definition of revival, and then what are some core constituents? What are those things that are going to go along when there is a revival? The very first day that I bought the book Thoughts on Religious Experience by Archibald Alexander, which book was so important for me for many years to come, I also had bought a book. It was the first of the books that I bought that were published by Richard Owen Roberts Publishing. Richard Owen Roberts is almost 92 now, but he was one of the living leading authorities on revival, him and Ian Murray and maybe some others. And this book was Lectures on Revival of Religion from 1840 by the ministers of Scotland. And I didn't pay a lot of attention right then because I was under awakening. Didn't have a lot that it would benefit me from. So I'd also bought the collected works of Richard Sibbes that day so I could have the Bruce read. But later, as I started to teach revival, and very few people are teaching this section of American history that I'm opening up, that's why I feel it's important to record it and do at least a decent job. But Lectures on Revival of Religion, Ministers of Scotland in 1840, has an introduction by William H. Hetherington, and Hetherington wrote a history of the Westminster Divines. And in his book, he says, the very term revival of religion, we are perfectly aware, causes some persons to recoil with a species of instinctive opposition, as if it, revival, inevitably brought before their minds nothing but images of wild and extravagant fanaticism. In such a state of mental antipathy, it is manifestly impossible that they can be benefited by the perusal, reading through, writings on a subject the mere designation of which arouses at once within them such a formidable array of hostile and stubborn prejudices. Yet this is equally unnecessary and unfair. It is unjust at once to the subject and to themselves. It would be surely more becoming to suspend their judgment about revivals till they had at least attempted to obtain somewhat of a more clear and accurate conception of the matter. Discarding prejudice and listening to reason, it would be well that they would ask themselves what the phrase really means, revival, whether in itself or in its common application, before allowing a mere name to startle them from their propriety. As each week I bring something to wet myself, I'm learning more and more what really is helpful. So today it's peppermint tea. When a single sinner is brought under the power of divine grace, and conversion or a saving change takes place in him, which may be known to no person except his immediate relations, mom and dad, maybe a sister, maybe a brother, and a pastor whose ministrations he attends, this can, of course, attract very little attention. One person, through the power of the Spirit and by the grace of God, is converted. It probably is not going to attract a lot of attention, and if it did, would not be called a revival. If, on the other hand, one who had formerly been soul converted but had relapsed into a careless state and in a great measure resumed his worldly habits should be awakened out of this dangerous situation of the soul, quickened and renewed in the spirit of his mind, neither would this be called a revival, although it actually was so in the strict meaning of the term. You have one person, he is revived, he was in a state of declension and lethargy and slothfulness, and he has been quickened by the Spirit and revived. So in the strict sense of the term, even though it's one individual, it is in fact a revival. Something is made alive or quickened, which had become dormant and still. But if many of either or both of such cases should occur in one vicinity and about at the same time so as to become evident to public observation, this would be termed a revival in the common acceptation of that phrase. When therefore men use or hear the term a revival of religion, it ought to be understood to mean an unusual manifestation of the power of the grace of God in convincing and converting careless sinners and in quickening and increasing the faith and piety of believers. It will at once be seen that a revival thus defined may be viewed in two distinctly different aspects, as manifested in these two different classes of people. Two aspects illustrated by two different classes of people, while its own essential character is one and the same in both. It is a life-giving, life-imparting, quickening, regenerating, and sanctifying energy of the Holy Spirit, converting the hardened sinner and reclaiming the backsliding or dormant Christian. So you're going to have conversions of people who were very hardened before, and you're going to have people who are in a backslidden, dormant situation be revived. So that's revival in the strictest sense of the term, and when it is manifested over a local assembly and spread throughout the neighborhoods, and then maybe from city to city, and then in a great measure it spread, that's what became known as the Great Awakening. And one thing I have discovered, and I'm not really sure why, but there's a lot of people out there that even maybe professing Christians that don't like the study of revival. And they've written books against the Great Awakening. Have one of them on my shelf. Inventing the Great Awakening. We invented it. And then he tries to show how we use these historic details to come up with the thing called an awakening. However, if you read Joseph Tracy's work, The Great Awakening, which was published in the year 1840, about 100 years after all this stuff took place, there's just too many individual pastoral accounts that detail the revivals as they came in their congregation. And, you know, you realize when you're teaching a revival, to do it justice, not usually the people that are in the room, but those who are hearing the recording, you almost have to be polemical, proving that this is in fact a reality. So what are the results if there is a revival? Number one, conviction of sin, one of the first manifestations of a work of the Spirit of God in an assembly. There's always conviction of sin, but here you see it start to spread and it becomes pungent, and sometimes people even cry out. Jonathan Edwards, in his work called Distinguishing Marks of a Work of the Spirit of God, saying of these manifestations of the Spirit, or what you witness, if they seem to have an extraordinary conviction of the dreadful nature of sin, the people that are affected by it, and a very uncommon sense of the misery of a Christless condition, or extraordinary views of the certainty and glory of divine things, and are proportionably moved with very extraordinary affections of fear and sorrow, desire, love, or joy, or if the apparent change be very sudden and the work be carried on with very unusual swiftness, and the persons affected are very numerous, and many of them are very young, with other unusual circumstances not infringing upon scripture marks of a work of the Spirit of God, these things are no argument that the work is not of the Spirit of God. In other words, if you see these things, it's probably an argument that there is a work of the Spirit of God, and if it's in an extraordinary and unusual degree of influence and power of operation, if it's in nature, it be agreeable to the rules and marks given in Scripture, is rather an argument in its favor that there is a revival that is going on. This is the description of the audience when the revival came to Northampton in 1734 and 1735. This is the first revival while Edwards was pastor, years before he preached his sinner's sermon. Quote, "There is a very great variety as to the degree of fear and trouble that persons are exercised with before they attain any comfortable evidences of pardon and acceptance with God." This is what you see in the revival. "Some are from the beginning carried on with abundantly more encouragement and hope than others. Some have 10 times less trouble of mind than others, in whom yet the issue seems to be the same. Some have had such a sense of the displeasure of God and the great danger they were in of damnation that they could not sleep at night. And many have said that when they have laid down the thoughts of sleeping in such a condition have been frightful to them. They have scarcely been free from terror while asleep, and they have awakened with fear, heaviness, and distress, still abiding on their spirits. It has been very common that the deep and fixed concern on persons' mind has had a painful influence on their bodies and given disturbance to animal nature." When they say animal nature, they're just talking about physiological effects. "The awful apprehensions persons have had of their misery have, for the most part, been increasing the nearer they've approached to deliverance, though they often pass through many changes and alterations in the frame and circumstances of their minds. Sometimes they think themselves wholly senseless, so they're under conviction, the burden is on the back, and yet they've gotten used to it. They feel like they actually need more conviction before they can come to Christ because, as Edward says, they're profoundly ignorant of themselves. So they believe they may have been given up to judicial hardness because they feel wholly senseless. Yet, they appear very deeply exercised about that fear in a great measure to obtain convictions again." So I'm just talking about what are the elements that you commonly see in a revival. Conviction of sin. And conviction of sin as in legal terrors. It's not conviction of sin like that which I would I do not, but the evil that I hate that I do not, for an unconverted person. When he feels conviction of sin because the manifest presence of God is upon the assembly, he is afraid because he feels that he is under the wrath of God. And he feels it. He can feel God's anger. That's a different kind of conviction that everybody is going to experience on the judgment day. But it is manifest considerably during a real revival when the presence of God comes upon an assembly. True revival is attended with prayer. One paragraph. "An account of a revival of religion in Plymouth, Connecticut in the year 1799 by Samuel Waterman." By the way, I just narrated this account. I just put this exact account up on sermon audio this morning because by reading these things, it makes me more familiar with them, though I have read this stuff before. All of these accounts, all of these stories that are related here, all of these stories came from the Connecticut Evangelical Magazine, and this magazine went on for 10, 15 years. And it wasn't just a collection of revival stories. There were excellent pictures of people, stories of people's conversion, missionary efforts. Remember, in 1800, that's before we were even exploring the Sandwich Islands, which became known as Hawaii. This is very, very early on in our history. In fact, in 1801, we had something that was called the Planning Union, where the Presbyterians and the Congregationalists would be working together to put missionaries out there. But I'm drawing attention to this magazine, and I have 3 or 4 copies of it. 3 of them are print on demand. That's actually the first edition. But the magazine was started because in 1800, because there were so many of these revivals going on. So this is where that's coming from. An encounter of a revival of religion in Plymouth, Connecticut in 1799. A religious meeting was now appointed on the Wednesday evening of the next week, and although the season and the traveling were both uncomfortable, many came from almost every quarter, and it seemed as if God was present to the truth, speaking to sinners in a still small voice and saying, "What have you been doing and where are you going? Consider what you do and what your end is like to be." After praying and singing, the people were addressed from these words, "Escape for your life. Look not behind you, neither stay thou in all the plain. Escape to the mountain, lest you be consumed." A solemn silence reigned among the hearers who appeared to hear as for their life. That language is going to come up again. When the Holy Spirit comes upon an assembly and he's quickening the word that's being heard from the pulpit, people's minds don't drift. They're hearing it. And I'll give you another example of this. As for their lives, like they've never heard anything that is so important, because in a new measure they're aware of the presence of God upon the preaching. A solemn silence reigned among the hearers who appeared to hear as for their lives, and many were to be seen in various parts of the house, weeping and trembling under a sense of their guilt and danger, and saying to themselves, "What must I do to be saved?" For at this time, but few spake out the feelings and exercises of their hearts. But at the close of the meeting, they returned to their homes in pensive sadness. From that time to the present, there have been almost every week from 2 to 5 and sometimes 6 religious meetings besides the 2 upon the Sabbath, as I have invariably attended them myself. I can witness to the order and decency, the silence and solemnity with which, and the numbers by which, these meetings have been attended. The silence observed among those who were going to or returning from these meetings was very impressive, and frequently noticed with surprise and pleasure. End quote. I don't think you could separate the two, but what I'm not can't guarantee is that they're actually going to be conversions, or if they're just going to be awakened. But I can't imagine, if the presence of God and this manifest presence came upon an assembly, the Christians are going to be alarmed, woken up, and those outside of God inevitably are going to feel conviction of sin. You can't be in the presence of God without it being manifest to your consciousness. So you could not possibly separate those things. But it's up to the sovereignty of God whether those legal fears issue into real conversions. True revival is the result most often in the word being preached and the desire of the listeners to hear often. They want to hear often. The preaching of Gilbert Tennent. Could you imagine, because you know who Whitfield is, and if, Whitfield, David Garrick, the actor, said that he thought that Whitfield could reduce an audience to tears just by the way he uttered the word Mesopotamia, because he had that kind of addiction and pathos. But George Whitfield said of Gilbert Tennant, who went preaching with him, that if you heard him, you must be either converted or enraged. He couldn't be indifferent. I'm giving these histories, even though this is from the First Great Awakening, because we're illustrating what a revival is. We're not in the history yet, but Gilbert Tennant, it is said of him. And the person that's writing this is Thomas Prince, who is a pastor in Boston, Massachusetts, who put together a history of the revivals that were going on in that time during America, which we have compiled, and they're in books like Gillies, Historical Collections and Revivals of Religion, that is up through like 1759, and they've added to it. But it was called A Christian History by Thomas Prince. He's the one that originally documented these revivals. He's a pastor in Boston, and they would send their revival reports to him, including Jonathan Edwards, what was going on in Jonathan Edwards' assembly. But Thomas Prince, a pastor of Boston, went to hear Gilbert Tennant himself because he had some notoriety. And he said of Gilbert Tennant, quote, "He seemed to have no regard to please the eyes of his hearers with agreeable gesture. nor their ears with delivery, nor their fancy with language, but to aim directly at their hearts and consciences, to lay open their ruinous delusions, show them their numerous secret hypocritical shifts in religion, and drive them out of every deceitful refuge, wherein they made themselves easy with the form of godliness without the power. And many who were pleased and a good conceit of themselves before now found to their great distress they were only self-deceived hypocrites. And though while the discovery was making, in other words, while they began to discover that they were building their houses on the sand, some of the hearers at first raged, they were angry, as they have owned to me and others. Yet, in the progress of the discovery, many were forced to submit. And then the power of God so broke and humbled them that they wanted a further and even a more thorough discovery. I see I was building my house on the sand before. I was scared to find it out. Now I want the remedy, and now I'm asking, search me, O God, and try my heart. If I have been deceived up to a point, give me more light and undeceive me. So it says they wanted a further and even a thorough discovery. They went to hear him, Gilbert Tennant, that the secret corruptions and delusions of their hearts might be more discovered. And the more searching the sermon, the more acceptable it was to their anxious minds. In true revival, many who are seen as having a profession of being Christians get exposed as hypocrites, building their houses on the sand. One more paragraph. An account of a revival of religion in Harwinton, Connecticut in the year 1799 by the Reverend Joshua Williams. Quote, some were wrought upon very suddenly. When it says wrought upon, that means the Holy Spirit is working upon us. They used to say wrought upon a lot. These people have been wrought upon. Wrought upon very suddenly and in such circumstances has made it evident that it was not of themselves or of any man, but of God. From the 14th to the 20th of April, there were 18 instances of hopeful conversion. Several were brought under sorrowful and distressing conviction at midnight on their beds. And many in such circumstances that it could not be accounted for on any principle but the sovereign power and mercy of God. At this time, the labor of preaching was easy indeed. But to detect the false hope to which many were prone, like drowning men who catch hold of anything that comes in their way, that was a difficult and critical business. Never did I feel the importance of the ministry and my own insufficiency as much as at this period. On the one hand, not to wound the lambs of Christ's flock, and on the other, not to encourage the unfounded hope of the self-deceiver, required the utmost caution and diligence. My usual practice was, if upon examination I found marks of a false hope, to tell the matter plainly. My friend, I think you have a false conversion. But if there were symptoms of a well-founded hope, I told them that they must prove their hope to be genuine by their future holy conduct. Always remembering that the heart is deceitful above all things, end quote. Now, remember what I said, when the Word comes with power, the Holy Spirit comes upon the Word and you catch every word of it, is if this is a really good example of this. And this is a Baptist pastor named Joshua Bradley, and he compiled a number of these accounts, and they were put into a magazine on revival sketches between 1812 and 1815 around New Hampshire. And I don't know if these are in there. It's also part of there are six books called the Revival Series that was put together by Richard Owen Roberts. And they include most of them here in America. One of them is called the Boston Revival of 1846, which, interestingly, of all of the things that I've narrated on revival, it's had the most downloads, like 2,000 or something. But all of these were within this revival series that was published by Richard Owen Roberts, and there were six of them. And I've tried to get all of them because, you know, this history is so interesting. But okay, so this is Ackworth, New Hampshire, 1814. Nothing has appeared like a revival in this town until 1814. And this year, the Reverend P. Cook was ordained. Communion after his consecration, 16 offered themselves to the church. Immediately after this, instances of individual conviction made their appearance in different parts of the society, and one and another were made to rejoice in God. Now, I love this sentence. I mean, you know, if we have an experience, at least it gives us some idea of the solemnity that is felt. A solemn and strict attention was paid to the word preached, and the good work progressed gradually until September 1816, in which time about 60 were added to the church. Every seat in the house of God was filled not with drowsy, inattentive hearers, but with awakened immortals hanging on the lips of the speaker with almost breathless attention, looking as if their everlasting all depended upon the proper improvement of a single sermon. That's what revival does when the Spirit comes upon the Word. People sitting there and they are hearing this in such... What was so striking... And I believe I have the story here, or I will get to it. Edward Dorr Griffin. Let me introduce these people as I think of them. I don't know if I have his. In 1973, when Ian Murray taught a series on revival, the works of Edward Dorr Griffin were... This is 73. So he got these books back into print, Banner of Truth, as well as other works that he had mentioned. And I was listening to these, so I eventually bought these. Lectures on Revival, William Sprague, 1832. The Law College, Archibald Alexander. The Sermons of Edward Dorr Griffin and Other Things, Brothers. They came into print, and they went back out of print because there is no desire to study this stuff. We don't have people teaching much on revival. And I think inevitably that's going to affect whether or not you're going to pray for it. I mean, you read these stories and you can say, how could I not want this to happen in our church? Jonathan Edward, during true revivals, there is an unusual vigor and gusto in the praise and singing. The revival at Northampton in 1733, our public praises were then greatly enlivened. God was then served in our psalmody, in some measure in the beauty of holiness. It has been observable that there has been scarce any part of divine worship wherein good men amongst us have had grace so drawn forth, and their hearts so lifted up in the ways of God as in singing his praise. Our congregation excelled all that ever I knew in the external part of the duty before. The men generally carrying regularly and well 3 parts of music, and the women a part by themselves, and now they were evidently wont to sing with unusual elevation of heart and voice, which made the duty pleasant indeed. So the singing becomes delightful. Those who are saved are rejoicing. And there needs to be a council to awaken sinners. And I have to define this term. I was sitting at one of our potlucks, and the person sat across from me, I was using the term about me being an awakened sinner, and they said, I don't know what that term means. But the best example is Acts 16:31. The Philippian jailer was indifferent, as long as prisoners were safe. And he hears a sound and he springs in and he says, what must I do to be saved? He is now awakened. Before he was asleep, he was indifferent. Now he is awakened to his need. And they use this terminology very, very often in revivals. The awakened sinner. The other term is the anxious inquirer. He's anxiously inquiring, what must I do to be saved? William Sprague, Lectures on Revival, Chapter 6, on treatment. He had a whole chapter, Treatment Due to the Awakened Sinner. A pastor asked him, oh, how do you counsel these people? You can't just get them to say the sinner's prayer. They're not even going to listen to you if you said anything like that. They're deeply afraid in many cases. And so much afraid at first, until God mercifully interposes and calms their anxious hearts, that they can't at first hear the good news. They're afraid because the laws open them up, they say, well, not for me, I'm such a great sinner. But then God in his mercy calms that fear down and makes the word come alive to them in regeneration. So Sprague says, lectures on revival about counseling or the treatment due to somebody who's awakened. He comes to you, pastor, what am I going to do? Scared, I realize I was building my house on my sand, or I realize I've been totally indifferent and now I feel the wrath of God is upon me. Quote, now you will readily perceive that it is a most responsible office to counsel and direct an individual in these interesting circumstances. The mind is in a state to be most easily influenced. An influence on a subject that involves all the interests of eternity. There is a sort of balancing of the soul between religion and the world, between heaven and hell, and no one can be certain that the weight of a single remark may not turn the scale one way or the other. Of what vast importance is it that all the suggestions and counsels that are offered at such a time should be scriptural, seasonable, the very instructions of the Holy Ghost? But if it be a responsible office for an individual to direct a single inquiring sinner, what shall be said of the responsibility of the church during a revival of religion in which there are many on every side pressing the inquiry what they shall do to be saved? And how important is it that members of the church should be so enlightened as to be safe guides on this momentous subject, that thus they may never put in a still greater jeopardy the interests of those whom they attempt to direct. A large part of the conduct of a revival consists in counseling the awakened. And on the manner in which this duty is performed, as much as anything, depend both the character of the work and its results. And so he just says, this is my design in this chapter. One, to consider in general the treatment due to an awakened sinner in a revival. And two, to contemplate some of the most prominent cases which require more special counsel and instruction. I am to present before you the general course proper to be taken with an awakened sinner. When a person in these circumstances comes to ask your counsel, the first thing you have to determine is, what is his amount of knowledge and his amount of feeling? And so on. Now, this is a really important time in the history. This is 1832, and so you're right on the eve of an Asa Hill Nettleton who knows that you can counsel awakened sinners. You can determine what they know, what their feeling is, what directions to give them, but you cannot instill the new birth into their heart. And this is a pivotal time, and at the same time there was being introduced the anxious seat. And Finney was using it, and I'm not saying that Finney was the first to use the anxious seat, anxious bench. And so I paid very close attention to the books that were written about this time, you know, to gain the balance, to warn against the things that were coming into revival. And there was a graduate of Princeton Theological Seminary named John Williamson Nevin, and he wrote the first book in 1643 I saw dealing with a subject called the anxious bench. And I thought about narrating that. I don't know how useful. For historic purposes, it could be very interesting. But, you know, back then, there were still safe guides. Now, we get people converted so easily, I think. Anyway, so, as we move from these basic things at the foundation of revival, I want to talk about why we're transitioning to the Second Great Awakening. First, mention something about the First Great Awakening and the pastors that were used. And there were many of them, but Jonathan Edwards is well known, George Whitfield is known, John and Charles Wesley are known. But there are also some good Presbyterian pastors who were very, very careful in how they guided people during this awakening. And numerous of these men became president of the College of New Jersey. The College of New Jersey was started by the Presbyterian Church as well to prepare men for the ministry. And the reason was these Christian, quote, colleges were being overtaken with liberalism. But many of these pastors who were used in these revivals became presidents of some of these colleges. It was a good time. And you could go to most of your colleges, certainly in the 1600s, and get training for the ministry, a seminary model in the United States never came around till 1808. And that was because they started a congregational seminary because liberalism was coming into Harvard, the congregational college, and they were teaching Unitarianism, which is a heresy on the Trinity. So leaving the Great Awakening behind, various estimates have been given of the number added to the churches during the Great Awakening. Dr. Cogswell, Christian philanthropist, thinks that probably the 25,000 were added to the churches in New England. Trumbull, who wrote a history of Connecticut, and his name is Benjamin Trumbull, and I'm sure they named the town of Trumbull, Connecticut after him. But Trumbull was another person that Ian Murray would name these historians, and if you want to teach this stuff, you try to gather their names. Benjamin Trumbull, The History of Connecticut, William H. Foote, Sketches of Virginia, Sketches of North Carolina, and so on. These were your historians. And Trumbull estimated that the number of converts in New England in 2 or 3 years, 30 to 40,000. Now, think about it, 30, 40,000, but what was the population of New England in the 1740s, 1750s. However, moving on, passing from the Glorious Revival period about the middle of the last century under the preaching of Jonathan Edwards, George Whitfield, the two tenets, Joseph Bellamy, and other apostolic laborers, we find the shadows of a long night. And this is what I was telling you. There was a state of declension that came in. And this is the reason for it after the first Great Awakening. We find the shadows of a long night settling down again upon the churches of the land. Like Israel of old, most of them were in the wilderness about 40 years and only kept alive by supplies of the heavenly man and the water from the rock. From the year 1745 to near the close of the century, the Holy Spirit withheld in a great measure those copious refreshings which had turned so many parched fields into gardens of the Lord and made their fruit shake like Lebanon. Now, at no time indeed during that period was it all dark, all barren. Doesn't mean there was no revivals anywhere whatsoever. All along here and there, over the wide ways, some precious revivals broke out like streams in the desert to keep alive the faith, and who mourned over the desolations of Zion. Towards the close of the period, there were more of these than I had supposed, till I met with notices of several unmistakable genuineness between 1770 and 1790 in New England and the Middle States, including the new settlements of Western Pennsylvania. So now the news is starting to come out in some of these new settlements, Western Pennsylvania, Western Virginia, as people were moving west, that there were again some indications of revival going on. So 1792 up to 1800. So the life of Edward Dorr Griffin, and he's worth mentioning here, and his name has been forgotten. So he was 6'3", about 300 pounds. And I like to tell the story because I like to read their childhood too. And he was a teenager, he was already a big boy. And he took a horse out to kind of break it in. And the horse stood on its hind legs and fell over on Edward Dorr Griffin. He was under the horse and they were worried about how bad he was injured. But I don't know, I said it's 6'3", 300 pounds. I'd probably worry about the horse, too. So, he entered on a course of study preparatory for the ministry under Jonathan Edwards, Jr. So, he trained under Jonathan Edwards, Jr., Jonathan Edwards' son. So, this is at the turn of into the 19th century. The names that you have forgotten were the great preachers of that time, and this man was a great preacher. And I wish I could find the story. Ian Murray relates a story that he got up to preach sometime and he's standing in the pulpit and the Spirit of God so came upon him that it just dropped him to his knees. And he just cried out because he's so overwhelmed. He said, if this doesn't humble me, nothing will. But I mean, these were great preachers and they walked close to the Lord and they did not daub with untempered mortar, as they say. You know what I mean? So he was licensed to preach the gospel in 1792. It was his privilege to engage at once in the work of bringing souls from nature's darkness into the light of the gospel. The first scene of his labors and his triumph very soon after his license was under his father's roof. Here was a family of 10, all of them but himself without Christ, alien from the Commonwealth of Israel. He immediately entered on those well-directed, efficient efforts for their spiritual good, which constituted his chief employment and delight during the remnant of his days, and which divine influence rendered signally successful. Now, this is one of the pastors like Asahel Nettleton that, I mean, it must have been a blessing, but certain pastors, him, Nettleton, it just seemed like anywhere where they went and they started to preach that God was bringing them there because he meant to bring revival. So they lived in the midst of revival. And the story goes that from his porch, he was in a pasture in Newark, New Jersey for a while, also Boston, but he could stand back on his porch, and this would have been 1800 or so. And he said he could point out and count 50 to 60 steeples of churches in the distance that he knew right then and there were having genuine revival in those churches. Real, the real thing. So it was spreading. It is believed that these influences upon Edward Griffin did in a measure return again before the year 1792 in occasional instances of what is distinctly styled a revival. We do not suppose that instances of this kind were very numerous, but whether they were many or few, it cannot be considered strange that they did not come to a knowledge of a youth, avowedly a man of the world and devoted to pursuits of altogether a different nature. So it's talking about the influence it had upon him as a young man. Soon after the time to which we have alluded, instances of the display of this power and grace became more numerous and more signal, and the subject of this story was an honored instrument in promoting them. Indeed, for the 16 or 17 succeeding years, the history of his life is little else than details of revival of religion. And this is Asahel Nettleton, and his name has been forgotten. And there was a seminary named after him, between him and Bennett Tyler, called Hartford Seminary. And there was a book written about Asahel Nettleton not long ago, 10, 15 years ago. And the author went up into the Hartford Seminary to see what he could find about Nettleton. And there's a picture of Finney up on the wall, and the picture of Nettleton is collecting dust off in the corner. It's just, this is evangelicalism in our day, you know. Because this man, during the confessional crisis at Princeton Theological Seminary, revolving around the doctrines of the imputation of Adam's sin to his posterity, the extent of the atonement, and, you know, total depravity mainly, that Nettleton was always a solid, solid Calvinist when it came to total depravity, which is interesting because this is Jonathan Edwards' grandson, Timothy Dwight. And Dwight was brilliant. And so the story I'm going to tell you is a revival that happened when Nettleton was attending Yale College and Dwight was the president. But this was a brilliant man, and I was saying that infidelity started to come in, and so there was a stated declension in the churches, and part of it was because of the Revolutionary War, as we needed French troops to help us in the battle. We were bringing in their infidelity, Thomas Paine, Voltaire, and so on. So how this affected the Christian colleges, Yale had 110 students. Maybe one of 10 even had a credible profession, and yet the college was really there to fair men for the ministry. But the tide changed and there was a revival. And this is the life of Asahel Nettleton by Bennett Tyler. I showed you Tyler's picture, the president of Dartmouth. It's an amazing story because he was the George Whitefield of the Second Great Awakening, and yet we've forgotten his name. At this time, in the winter of 1807 and 1808, a revival of religion began in New Haven and in Yale College. So Dwight is the president. Nettleton is a student at the time. The first subjects of it, the revival, among the students were in the freshman class. Asahel Nettleton was no indifferent spectator, but among the first to discover indications of special religious impressions and to seek out persons in a state of religious anxiety. So he would go around from class to class and see people who already he could tell were affected by this revival. Then, contrary to what I had before witnessed of intimacy between the upper and lower classes, Often did I see him, Nettleton, with one or two heart-burdened youth of the youngest class, walking arm in arm in the college yards before evening prayers, conversing upon the great interests of the soul. I observed that so soon as he became acquainted with the student under religious impressions, so that's just another, he's awakened. He's under religious impressions. He's under conviction of sin. And I know I'm stressing these things, but a lot of people miss these in the stories on revival because we use the terminology different. So he's finding people under religious impressions so that he could try to alleviate the burden as an evangelist that's on Christians' back. It was manifested as conversation with such individuals. His silent and ostentatious labors in connection with his Christian brethren in their meeting for prayer and conference held a very prominent and important place in that memorable and joyful season. He's talking about the revival now at Yale, 1807. In addition to the foregoing statement, a few other facts connected with the history of the college life will now be mentioned. In the American Quarterly Register for February 1838, there is a history of revivals in Yale College. One page, 299, in the account of the revival in 1808 is the following statement, quote, "There was one case in this revival which awakened very general sympathy, and to which I shall advert for a moment, because it shows how God sometimes makes use of the sufferings of one to subdue the obstinacy of another. A member of one of the lower classes, so a freshman or a sophomore, became deeply anxious for his spiritual welfare at the commencement of the seriousness or the awakening. He was indeed the first person in college probably who was under conviction of sin. As the work went on," the revival continues to go on, "others who were awakened at a much later period were apparently brought into the kingdom and were rejoicing in hope, while he, this awakened sinner, was left in the bitterness of despair, with the arrows of the Almighty drinking up his spirit. His health rapidly declined under his sufferings. He was confined in a great measure to his bed, and it was feared that, with a feeble constitution, he must soon sink under the weight of his distress. Unless relief should be obtained, in an adjoining room there lived an avowed disbeliever in spiritual religion." So he says he's going to give up under the weight of distress if help doesn't come very soon. Now, I have to make the transition, because I confused you. In an adjoining room, so listening in, adjoining room, there lived an avowed disbeliever. So in the next room, there's an atheist in spiritual religion who denied the reality of a divine influence in revivals. And from the commencement of the present work, had regarded those who were concerned in it with scorn. He made fun of them. A Christian friend who knew his sentiments asked him to visit the sufferer. Come and see this man. See this guy who's under this conviction and tell me if this is a fiction. Come here, take a look at this. So he led him toward the bedside. He stood for a moment looking at the emaciated form before him. He listened to the exclamations which told the distress and horror of an awakened conscience. And then turning, went back to his room to weep there under a sense of its own sin. Not long after, to the wonder of all of his companions, it was said of him as Saul of Tarsus, "Behold, he prayed." This is the story of the guy who's under this awakening. "Behold, he prays." He afterwards entered into the ministry and devoted himself to the cause of missions, and has been for more than 20 years an active and successful laborer upon the heathen ground. Now that is the atheist. Okay, the atheist goes back to his room, weeps under a sense of his sin, he's so convicted. And not long after, the atheist, to the wonder of all of his companions, it was said of him as Saul of Tarsus, "Behold, he prays." So it's the atheist that afterwards entered into the ministry and devoted himself to the cause of missions, and has been for more than 20 years an active and successful laborer upon heathen ground. So he was brought under conviction by seeing somebody under conviction. The reader may be interested to learn the issue of those sufferings which led to this happy result. So now we're talking about the guy who's under great duress, he's under fear, he's emaciated because he's in such depression. I shall give the relation in the words of one who is best able to speak on the subject. It was just at the close of the term and late at night. So it's near the end of the semester. It's late at night. And remember, Asa Hellnettle and Timothy Dwight. The hour was late, but they said that a few Christian friends lingered about the bed of the agonized and despairing sinner, and many were the prayers offered that the balm of Gilead might be applied to his wounded spirit. At length, a messenger was dispatched to summon the president. Bring the president in here. We need somebody to help us. This is serious. As it seemed to those in attendance that unless relief were had, death must close the scene. This guy was under such conviction they thought he was going to die. The hour was late, but Dwight, Timothy Dwight, the one that wrote the song we sang Sunday, I love thy kingdom, Lord, that's Timothy Dwight. At length, however, taking a seat by the bedside, he gradually directed the anxious inquirer to the divine sufficiency, the infinite fullness of the Lord Jesus, recited the invitations of the gospel, and then followed his paternal counsel by prayer to God. That's what Timothy Dwight is doing for the student that's under such duress. That prayer, it is believed, was heard, and the words which he spoke were a healing balm from on high. A sweet serenity seemed to steal over the agitated sinner's mind, a serenity which was a harbinger of a joy that came in a short time after and was unspeakable and full of glory. What is interesting, and it doesn't mention it here, but somebody who knew Nettleton during this said that he could hear Nettleton in the next room as Dwight was counseling the sinner, that Nettleton was crying out to God with all of his might that this young awakened sinner would be born of God. Now, what was so good about that? This revival came to Yale College, and also another revival came to the College of New Jersey, of which Ashbel Green was the president at that time. And I probably showed you, I have a book with Ashbel Green's actual signature in there. But I'm going to open it up for questions because that's just all I had for a basic introduction today. And next Thursday or Friday, whatever we decide on, and if anybody could be there, I'll go ahead and get the material for the Kentucky Revival of 1800 because I think that fits in very, very well because really, that's really an early revival, 1800. Our country was very, very new in the year 1800. Go ahead, Michael. Well,
I guess this, I don't know if that really could be considered a revival because...
Well, in some revivals, the work and the conviction and all that could be sped up at a quicker rate. God hasn't limited himself to how much tear or conviction anybody is going to go through prior to coming to Christ. But if you study out the Greek words for they were cut to the heart when Peter preached that sermon, the fears that are common during a revival was definitely there in Acts 2 and so on when Peter preached. I mean, the Bible is so succinct in some places. We don't have a lot of wording, but we know enough to know that those guys were convicted that they had committed deicide. They murdered God, the God. We can already use the foundation that has been laid about conviction in a Christian to answer that, and that is, remember when I was talking about assurance of salvation is sometimes withheld from those who are in a sorry condition, the state of declension. And if a person would be under that same sorry state, he, you know, is basically in a state of declension, asleep, and so on. If revival comes, I mean, let's be honest, he is going to inevitably at first feel fear. And then he begins to examine himself and wonder if he ever came to Christ aright. And he will feel the same type of fears in the manifest presence of God as if he had never been converted at all. And he may set out to a state of self-examination and discern that, well, I really have been a believer, but I have not been living up to that light. But if a person is in a good way, as you could suppose that Jonathan Edwards and others who were walking so close to the Lord, I narrated the story of what happened to Sarah Edwards during a revival. She was having such rapturous joys that she thought she was going to swoon and pass out just by somebody reading the words to a hymn by Isaac Watt. And it's over probably an hour and a half to read this whole account. It was so full. And so it is a great time to believers, but what's interesting was a statement in a sermon that I heard by Pastor Martin. And he said that he had an opportunity to talk to somebody who was really going off the stage from the Welsh Revival of 1905. You know, he was probably an old man. Martin was quite a young man. And somebody had asked his pastor, it must have been great to preach during the revival, the Welsh Revival of 1905. And his answer was interesting because he said, want to preach? We didn't want to preach. We all wanted to hide. And I think that's interesting because I could see where that initially could happen. When the manifest presence of God comes upon an assembly and you have even most of your pastors in a state of indifference and just going through the motions and then revival comes, I could see pastors saying, you know, it's frightening.
Well, but even John, I don't know, I mean, obviously this is not exactly the same, but when Jesus reveals himself to John in the beginning of the book of Revelation, John was terrified. I mean, you know, even if you were in a good way spiritually, there's something about God's presence that, you know, you can't just sit there and say, oh, well, I'm in a good way, I'm not afraid at all.
Well, and there's two stages to it, you see. Every time that, even in the case of believers, like Daniel and Daniel 10, John and Revelation 1, but even in the case of the shepherds who were watching their sheep at night, and they have this glorious vision, and it doesn't say that God himself was there, but they were very, very frightened, that even those who are very, very dear to God, in order for them to rightly understand who it is that, even though he's about to comfort them with great news, he still very often humbles them and makes them afraid before he gives them the good news. First, Moses has to see the burning bush and take the shoes off of his feet because he's on holy ground. But it answers another question, and that is, as you look at the Asbury Revival and so on, the one thing that just cannot be present in a revival is any kind of levity, humor. When the presence of God is upon an assembly, you're going to see people practice the regulative principle like they never have before, even those who claim that I really don't know what it is or how it is to be obeyed. But if revival really came to this church, then the demeanor of the people before the preaching is just going to be inevitably very, very reverent. And it's interesting when you're really, really drawn close to God. At first, you know, there's some uncomfort there. And you don't want the light to shine in, you know. You see that which is still remaining. And yet you realize if I don't open up and just say, God, just purge me, but do it through the grace of your Son, or otherwise I'll be undone in this process. Anything strike you in this study, Blake?
Well, first, that always reminds me in Isaiah chapter 6, when Isaiah sees the holiness of God, And he says, I've seen the holiness of God in my own. I'm a man of unclean lips, for I dwell in a land of unclean lips. And I think that's a really great biblical example, because he was humbled by the holiness of God, the manifestation presence of him. So regarding to all this, I was going to make another comment, but I want Jason to also join in on this discussion as well. So regarding all this, if a revival would break out in our modern world, what would that look like?
It depends on what kind of revival it was. The Great Awakening kind of got its name because it wasn't just the local assemblies that were experiencing that. And I don't know how to explain this. I can only go by the reports. But people could actually tell as they're riding in wagon and horse that there was a place that you would get within a population and a vicinity that right there as you entered in, you felt the manifest presence of God. And the entire county, parish, or whatever. See, some revivals are very much centered in a local church. But what's interesting about the Great Awakening, that presence of God was felt out in the field as well. And these are the type of things that were going on in the Kentucky revival. It's really, really pretty remarkable that as these things grow and you can't keep them within a building, they have to go out and they spread out into the forest and so on. And that's why it became a camp meeting, because people were coming from all other parts of Kentucky. And inevitably, they're not going to be able to get home that night. So they set up camp and they stayed there. So the camp meeting originally was out of necessity. But what has happened with all of the things is the camp meeting becomes part of the process for there to be a revival. If I can get the camp meeting, if I can get the chopped down trunks, because in a forest, he had to cut the tree within 2 to 3 feet of the ground so that the preacher could get up so he could be seen above the crowd. But if the things that are conveniences, and this is what our confession talks about, some things are just conveniences. They're neither in and of themselves wrong or right. They just assist us with the worship without violating the regulative principle. But what happened with these, quote, camp meetings, and as this stuff started to get popular, the camp meeting and the different things that are going on that are the peripherals, or those outside of the revival that aren't of the Spirit themselves, people try to manufacture the revival again by bringing those things within the revival assembly and congregation. And they had a name for them called the New Measures. And Finney was very, very big on these, and those are the things that would be worthwhile getting into in the future, that by bringing in these, quote, new measures into the assembly, he thought that it was a means to the ends of starting a revival. But all this stuff got abused. As what's so helpful about the definition from the Ministers of Scotland is that excitement, bodily manifestations, and other things are consequences of a revival that aren't necessarily wrong. However, those animal emotions and that which the physical body produces in itself cannot be spiritual. The only part of the revival that is abiding is when the Holy Spirit works upon our spirits, conforming us to the image of His Son. So that comes by the means of grace He's given us, the preaching and singing and exhorting one another and so on.